This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hola, my podcasting friends. This is Manitoba This Week. I'm Marcy Marcusa, bringing you the best of the prairies straight to your earbuds. Inside this edition, the latest way to prevent cancer is to get thin. But how literally should we take this advice compared to all of the other information out there? Plus, Facebook kerfuffle. We're going to hear from a member of the Facebook group that celebrates throwing things at sex trade workers on Higgins. But first, delivering a message of peace. James Loney spoke in Winnipeg this week about his experiences as a hostage in Iraq, but not without controversy. Find out why. Well, James Loney, the former hostage, did speak in Winnipeg this week, but not at the place where he was originally invited. James Loney was originally supposed to speak at a conference put on by the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Winnipeg. But Loney, who is gay and differs with the Catholic Church's stand on some issues, was then uninvited. In a moment, we'll hear what he had to say about this, but first, some of his talk. Loney spoke in front of hundreds of people at Augustine United Church in Osborne Village. He talked about the motivations of the men who captured him and three other Christian peace workers in Iraq 2 years ago.
One of our captors, we called him Number One. And on the first night, we had a conversation with him, blindfolded and handcuffed and terrified, but nonetheless tried to have this conversation. And we were saying to him, you know, we are members of Christian peacemaker teams. We are here because we're against the occupation. We're against the invasion. We want there to be peace. We want to tell the stories of the Iraqi people so that this can change things in the United States. And he said, oh yes, I know. I love the peaceful man. And he said, I would like you to see something. So he pulled out a photo which had a picture of four children. And the oldest was about seven, Mohammed. And then there was Mohammed. And then there was Noor. And then the baby, Zainab, about 1 year old. And he said, these are my sister's children. And they were killed at a checkpoint. The Americans opened fire on their car and killed them. All of them, seven people, all my sister's family. He said, I died that night when that happened. There was only one thing I can do, and that is to fight for Iraqi freedom. And there was another man, we called him Junior. He was the youngest of the group. He was about 25, going on about 13 years of age. And he said that he was from Fallujah. This Fallujah, this Fallujah, was like a battle cry. And I don't know if you remember, Fallujah has been surrounded by U.S. Marines and bombarded, and it was the old and the sick and the very poor who were left behind, and some insurgents, and they just bombed the hell out of that place. He was from Fallujah, and he said that his parents' house, his home, had been bombed, and that his parents, his sister, his fiancé, and his best friend had been killed by this. And another man also was from Fallujah, now living in Baghdad as a refugee because his house had been bombed. So these men had very visceral reasons for why they were doing what they were doing.
James Loney spoke at the Augustine United Church this week. He received a standing ovation from the large crowd. Now, Loney was originally, as mentioned, invited to speak at a conference put on by the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Winnipeg. The Archbishop says Loney was uninvited because he is publicly opposed to some church teachings. Here's what Loney said to reporters about that.
It's a reflection, and it's a sad reflection, I think, of the state of the Catholic leadership, that they are responding by silencing people when what we need is an open dialogue and debate about our disagreements, and
And I'm hopeful that we can have that conversation. And I think if the church is going to restore the credibility that it's lost around sexual issues, it will need to open up the doors of dialogue.
Some other people might say that how is the message going to get across, and how are these dialogues going to be opened if you don't take a harder stance, more authoritative, maybe be a little bit angry? What do you say to people that say that?
You know, in the Catholic Church, we are members of one communion, of one body, and we have to make spaces for all people to somehow be together in that. And I think taking a narrow, strident approach, it just creates more division.
This, you know, the story of the uninvitation and the circumstances surrounding it was on national news. It's what people have been talking about. Has your message of peace been overshadowed by a conflict?
I don't know. I'm not maybe in the best position to judge that. I worried about that, that might be the case. But I think the bishop's decision resulted in a lot more attention being brought to the conference and to my speaking than there would have been otherwise. So maybe it had that positive effect.
James Loney is one of four members of the Christian Peacemakers teams taken hostage in Iraq 2 years ago. Well, Winnipeg's Roman Catholic Archdiocese had quite a mess on its hands after the situation of inviting and uninviting Loney to speak at their social justice conference. Archbishop Weisgerber told Information Radio he had been under a lot of pressure to cancel Loney's participation in the conference. Well, the CBC found the woman who started the campaign to get rid of James Loney. Maria Sleikerman is the Manitoba president for Campaign Life Coalition. She spoke with Alex Friedman on Up to Speed.
First of all, how did you go about convincing the Archbishop to dump James Loney?
Well, it is a policy of the Catholic Church not to invite people like that. So I wrote him a letter, let him know what was about, and he uninvited him.
I mean, I understand it wasn't as simple as just writing a letter, though.
Yes, it was just writing a letter.
Just one letter?
Yeah, just one letter.
And so he responded to it, obviously. Now, what is it exactly for you? Why were you opposed to James Loney speaking at the Social Justice Conference?
Because there is a policy in the church that says that people like that are not supposed to be invited. Like in the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, they have a policy, and it was approved by Vatican, which bans giving supporters and of abortion and same-sex marriage a pedestal at a Catholic event.
Right. I guess the other side of that coin, though, is that we all believe that there's room for free speech in any sort of organization. Do you believe that there's room in the Catholic Church for people to question these tenets, these rules?
No, there is not. People know that what the church stands for, and one of the things is that they could turn people we have a law, you know, we have a lot in the Catholic Church that tells us that abortion and a homosexual is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were also opposed to Bill Blakey speaking. He has come and gone. What harm has been done with that?
I don't know. I know he is against what we stand for. He's pro-abortion. He is pro-homosexual. And so I didn't think it was appropriate for him to speak as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, so you did win one of the battles, mind you. Were you surprised that you won?
Yes, I was.
Well, why is that?
Well, because I didn't think anybody was going to take any notice.
And someone did.
Goodness. Well.
Did you have any idea that this would become such a big national issue?
No. But then I waited for about a week, 10 days, and then I sent it to LifeSite, which is a pro-life organization, a pro-life site, which backs us up. It's affiliated with Campaign Life Coalition.
Okay. Are you still friends with the Archbishop?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. So you approve of how he
My Archbishop.
Of course. Goodness me. Well, Maria, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate you taking the time to talk to us and give us your reaction to how things unrolled this weekend.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That's Maria Sleikerman, Manitoba President for Campaign Life Coalition. The James Loney story really struck a nerve with many of our radio listeners. We'd like to know what you think as well. Email us at manitobapodcast@cbc.ca. Well, another controversial story this week has to do with a Facebook group that celebrates throwing things at sex trade workers on Higgins Avenue. The group is called, quote, "For those people who have thrown something at those lovely girls on Higgins." Now, members of the group brag about throwing objects such as pennies or Timbits at sex trade workers. Arts reporter Christopher Reed reached a member of the group by telephone, and he joined Margot Watt on Up to Speed.
So what's this new Facebook site all about?
Well, Facebook, as you know, is a social networking website. It allows you to set up a web page with your name and photo on it, and you can use it to find old friends or stalk people. One of the things people do on Facebook is form groups devoted to specific interests. So long story short, someone started a group called "For Those People Who Have Thrown Something at Those Lovely Girls on Higgins," as you mentioned. And as the name implies, it's a forum for people to share stories about throwing things at sex trade workers.
And what kinds of messages are people posting on this page?
Well, many people write a line or two about items they've thrown at sex trade workers. One fellow writes, "There's a Mohawk near Selkirk Avenue in the dirty north that sells $1 Slurpees. We went in and got like 13 of them and kept driving by the same hooker one night. Good times."
So what kind of response is this group getting from the Facebook community?
Well, there's a fellow named Clayton Wilson. He saw the group and decided to start his own group. His group is called "Shut Down For Those People Who Have Thrown Something at Those Lovely Girls on Higgins." And Clayton's a Winnipegger who is studying poli-sci at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. And Clayton calls the original group a hate propaganda page.
You know, my first reaction was emotional, but then I got philosophical, you know, and I started thinking about like what Mahatma Gandhi says, you know, that the test of a civilization is the way, you know, that we treat our most vulnerable members. So, you know, in Canada, we like to think of ourselves as a very liberal society, is very tolerant. You know, we have multiculturalism, so-called. You know, however, when you look at something like this in, you know, on Facebook, which is a public forum, and people that really think that it's, you know, it equates the norm or something, that it's perfectly acceptable, then it kind of makes you ask some questions about Canadian society.
Now, as well as forming this counter group, Clayton has filed a complaint about the original group to Facebook, but so far Facebook hasn't responded, and I also was unable to get any response from Facebook on this. Clayton's group, by the way, has 375 members when I last checked, and the original group has 54 members.
Now, you've spoken to someone from the original group?
Yes, I spoke with a young woman named Nicole who asked that her last name not be used, but she's a 19-year-old second-year student at the University of Winnipeg and a member of the pro-throwing things at sex trade workers page. I should point out that some of the members of this page do seem to be quite young, you know, a lot of them are high school age. But here's Nicole explaining her involvement in the group.
Well, I know that when I was 13 on gate night, myself and an older boyfriend of mine and a couple of his friends decided we would drive down Higgins and throw muffins out the window. So I'm totally guilty. It was about 6 years ago. So I would never have imagined it would be blown out of proportion as to such an extent as it is in this whole group that labels this whole, the original group as racist and something about Robert Picton and like, wow. I just find it interesting how free speech is only allowed so long as it conforms to the prevailing political doctrine, and you don't say something that is contrary to that. Wow, I'm just still in shock.
So how does she respond to Clayton Wilson's accusation that this is hate propaganda?
Well, she prefers to see it not as hate, but as a kind of natural response to a social problem.
Our city is disgusting. Like, you can't even, like, you know, it's just that street has such a high populace of that. It's so concentrated there. It's so normalized, like, you know what I mean? It's so normalized there that you drive down there and they're everywhere, and it's disgusting to see. And I understand, like, child prostitutes are terrible, but our city is just overrun. Like, I won't be staying in this city specifically for the fact that it's so, it's just going downhill so fast. Like, you can't even walk, I won't even walk down Main Street by myself because I don't want to get robbed or I don't want to get shanked or, like, and if anything, then this group is an expression of anger towards the way that, like, why should we have to live in something like this?
So she obviously doesn't seem to think that there's anything wrong with this this page, but a lot of people do think there's something wrong with it. It will be interesting to see whether Facebook sees anything wrong with it and whether they'll take any action on this. In the meantime, tempers are getting pretty hot in this bizarre little culture war. The messages are really heating up between these two groups.
Wow, what a story. Thanks, Chris.
That was arts reporter Christopher Reed with an update about an unusual Facebook kerfuffle. Well, you're listening to Manitoba This Week, coming at you from Winnipeg, where the days are getting shorter and the promise of shortbread is just around the corner. But you might want to think twice before you indulge in too many sweets. This week, the World Cancer Research Fund released a new cancer prevention study. And its biggest advice? You should stay as thin as possible without going underweight. So Terry McLeod and I calculated our body mass indexes on air. We found that he's overweight and I'm in fact in the obese category. But it does seem like every day we're told to do something new to prevent cancer. So we wanted to know how literally we should take this new advice. Dr. Matthew Sefdell is a medical oncologist at Cancer Care Manitoba, and he helped us to answer some of our questions.
Now, let's look at some of the kinds of things that people do to avoid cancer risk. You know, first, we people quit smoking, then they're told to eat more tomatoes, drink a glass of red wine a day, avoid excess weight. Now we're being told that even small amounts of alcohol are bad for you. How literally should we take each and every report that comes out on this?
So the question of what causes cancer and how we prevent cancer is a complicated one because there's lots of different causes and lots of different types of cancers that have different mechanisms. And one should, it's difficult to generalize about all cancers as one group, but there are a number of cancers that are common and are preventable by some of the things that you've mentioned already. Smoking is a risk factor for many cancers. And a very, very important one. I won't. The subject of this conversation is not specifically about cancer. It's about weight and nutrition, and that alone is also a very important cause. So it's been estimated, and specifically by a very recent study, that about a quarter to a third of cancers are preventable by changes in diet and nutrition. And it's not so much what you should be doing there, it's really what you shouldn't be doing. In other words, it's not so much prescriptive as just giving lifestyle advice about factors that are probably bad for us and that we should be avoiding.
But this report suggesting that we keep our weight on the lower end of our body mass index, can you explain what that means?
Well, the body mass index, as you have seen by your own calculations, is a calculation that's based on your height and your weight. So it takes into account that there are different body shapes. And overall, we all probably have a slightly different set point. In other words, your normal is different from person to person. We can't all look the same.
It's the big bone theory, right?
It's the big bone theory, correct. And there's a genetic element there as well. However, there is probably a normal range for everyone, and we should endeavor to try and keep to as close as possible to that. Aiming for specific numbers is probably less important than just aiming for a healthy lifestyle, and that number will then come.
I'm surprised to hear you say that a quarter to a third of the entire population, if they did this, you know, would reduce your risk by a quarter to a third.
Yes.
Is there any way to extrapolate individually? So if I say 100 pounds is an enormous amount of weight, but that would put me at the low, low end of my normal weight. Is there any way to tell how much my risk of cancer might go down if I did that?
So it's very difficult on an individual basis. And to make that prediction, you would have to look at very specific factors about yourself. And that's probably best discussing actually with a medical practitioner. Mm-hmm. So, for example, your age, whether you're male or female. I obviously know the answer for you there, Marcy, but as a general, as a general point, as well as a family history of cancers and other factors as well.
So people can go to their doctors.
Yes, but overall, on a population level, and certainly this would apply to Canadians, is that you can cut your risk by changing diet and nutrition.
But talking a little bit about alcohol, it had been suggested that a glass of red wine a day is probably a good thing, a beneficial thing. Now, apparently, even small amounts of alcohol can increase your risk of cancer. What are we supposed to do here? Some people have a little glass of wine and say, I'm doing a good thing, I'm relaxing at the end of the day, I'm winding down, and that has to be a good thing. How do you reconcile those things?
So that's a very challenging issue, because we know that there is probably some health benefit to small amounts of alcohol in terms of heart disease, which is a very big public health issue as well, particularly in North America and Europe. And so the authors of this very large study had tried to take that into account by saying, although there's probably some small risk from even small amounts of alcohol for cancer, the benefits of a small amount of alcohol in terms of preventing heart disease outweigh that. So they haven't completely removed the ability for people to take alcohol, but just tried to minimize it. So the idea being, for women, one drink or one so-called unit of alcohol a day, and two for men, because men metabolize alcohol slightly more efficiently.
Now, just before you go, though, when we put all the cancer risks or cancer-causing agents, or I'm not quite sure the right language to use, if you put them together, environmental factors, diet, genetics, lifestyle, which one matters the most?
Well, the great question, and hard to – you've put me on the spot. I would say that I think that smoking and diet and nutrition probably share the gold medal there.
So really? Diet and nutrition is as significant as smoking.
Yes. I mean, we're talking about different cancers.
Yes.
The single most common cancer that we still see in this country and basically for the world is lung cancer. And 85% of that is attributable to smoking cigarettes, either by yourself or secondhand smoke. For some of the other cancers, diet and nutrition is more important. For example, cancer of the colon and rectum, and cancer of the breast in older people, and cancer of the uterus.
Thanks for this morning, Dr. Seftel.
Thank you.
Dr. Matthew Seftel is a medical oncologist at Cancer Care Manitoba. By the way, if you just do a simple Google of BMI, you'll find the body mass index calculator if you want to check out where you fall in the guidelines. Well, in addition to cancer, controversy, and all of those other happy topics, this week we also explored divorce on CBC Radio. Now, it sounds like a downer, but actually, Legal Aid Manitoba is taking a new approach to settling domestic disputes, and it's helping to speed up the process and cut costs. The CBC's Ruth Shedd checked into it.
So what's Legal Aid doing?
Well, Manitoba Legal Aid is using what's called collaborative family law. So say a couple is going to get a divorce. They have to work out who gets the house, how to split up the assets, when their children should get to see which parent. Well, Legal Aid will help them settle all of these issues without going to court. This is different from settling out of court through litigation, because both lawyers and both clients sign an agreement at the very beginning of the process saying they will not go to court. The lawyers are trained in both law and mediation. They sit down and have actual four-way conversations where they work together to come up with a settlement. Rhonda Herkus is a partner with Monk Goodwin LLP. She is the person who brought collaborative law to Manitoba.
I'm able to build trust not only with my client, but also with the other party. The four of us are there not trying to get an edge over the other person. What we're there for is to try and find a solution that helps the whole family. For me, it's the only way to do this well.
So, Ruth, why did Legal Aid bring this in?
Well, this summer, CBC reported that the province is facing a shortage of divorce lawyers. Fewer than 80 lawyers are willing to work on divorce cases. That's less than half the number normally employed by Legal Aid. When there aren't enough family lawyers, more people act as their own lawyers. And when people represent themselves, they're less likely to get the arrangements they want. It can tie up the court systems. Judges can even refuse to grant a divorce. So they had to do something. In 2004, Legal Aid Manitoba introduced a collaborative family law project. Catherine Lovegrove is a supervising attorney at Winnipeg Law Office.
The thinking was that
we would be able to service more clients with fewer lawyers if we use this process. The second objective of Legal Aid, of course, was to help clients resolve issues themselves with the help of social workers and child experts and some outside resources to help prevent them from coming back and trying to vary orders that maybe the courts imposed on them that they're not very happy with.
Lovegrove also says that through litigation, a very busy family lawyer can handle about 13 to 14 cases a month. With collaborative law, they can handle 20, maybe even a few more.
So how did that pilot program end up turning out?
Well, the pilot program was so successful, as of this year, collaborative law is now a full-time service of Legal Aid. 2,770 clients have been through the collaborative law project. That's almost 15% of their files. Almost all of these cases have been resolved without having to go to court.
So why do the people involved think it works so well?
Well, Catherine Lovegrove says not only is it more efficient, it helps clients come up with a plan that benefits both parties, and it leaves them with better communications tools to use with their former partner.
When you put people in a room and you have an opportunity to get to the heart of what's really causing their conflict, whether it's a comment made 5 years ago when someone found out they were pregnant, whether it's unfortunately, the marriage breaking down because of maybe third-party involvement or addictions. If you can get to the heart of it and they can see and hear the impact of their actions on the other person and understand that's where the anger is coming from, quite often we will have someone say, I'm really sorry for doing that or saying that, having you go through this. The minute that apology comes out on the table, it's like a brand new ballgame. People are prepared to think future. They're prepared to say, okay, we can let go of the past and we can start thinking about what can we do in the future for our kids and get rid of some of the conflict. It's very powerful.
There must be some situations, though, where it wouldn't work. Is it for everyone?
It's not for everyone. There are things like when you're dealing with an addiction or a mental illness, collaborative law will not benefit these people. But listen to what Catherine Lovegrove says here.
Surprisingly, where there's domestic violence involved, we always give the client who's been the subject of the domestic violence the option to participate or not. We're finding a lot of clients who have been subjected to domestic violence still want this piece because at the end of the day, they have to parent together. If we can put protection orders in place when necessary, but help them at least put a plan together, we're finding that even in those situations, it can work.
So finally, Ruth, does it save money?
Well, yes. When you go to court, there are lots of costs because litigation results in motions, examinations, assessments. So think about every time one party comes up with an offer. Then that lawyer has to write a letter and give it to the other lawyer. That lawyer has to show it to his or her client. They have to revise it, send it back. With collaborative law, it is literally put right out there on a table during a four-way conversation. It eliminates the cost lawyers spend on preparing for motions as well as court costs. Catherine Lovegrove says it also frees up resources so they can serve more clients.
We don't have the paperwork. Our meetings are lengthy. We might sit down with our clients in a four-way for 2 hours. We might do that twice. But we're not spending the time that a litigation lawyer would spend on the same case. And we're getting the same results, or I think at times better results.
Ruth, it sounds, though, like something that would benefit more than just legal aid clients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's similar savings. People do use this in private law. Rhonda Herkes, the lawyer who brought collaborative law to Manitoba, says it's not just for easy cases either. She's used collaborative law to settle millions of dollars in assets where people are arguing over every last shoelace.
I have yet in 20 years to have anybody come in my office who says, gee, I want to get into a real court battle and I really want to pay you $60,000 in legal fees. I've just been lying awake nights thinking about how I want to do this. Everybody comes in and says, can we keep this out of court? I don't want to have to go to court. I've heard the horror stories. And I say, yeah, there's a way.
And this project, this is catching on. Manitoba Legal Aid is not only a leader in Canada when it comes to using collaborative law, it's a leader in the world. Provinces BC, Ontario, Alberta, New Brunswick, Newfoundland, they've all shown interest in implementing this in their provinces, their legal aid systems. And recently, delegates from China even visited Manitoba to find out more. So that's pretty exciting.
All righty. Well, thanks, Ruth.
You're welcome.
That's the CBC's Ruth Shedd. Well, whether you're sharing a home or you've got your own, have you ever thought about a greener way to renovate, but then thought, well, it's probably going to be too expensive or just too difficult? The CBC's Megan Ketchison started looking into that, and she then told us about a Winnipeg man who can take your home and make it green.
So tell us about this fellow you found.
Well, his name's James Budahan, and he created Urban Zen Developments in the city just a few months ago. And you might have seen some of his signs around town. It says, "I take homes and make them green." And he told me he used to work for an architecture firm and really liked how they applied all of these LED or LEED standards. That stands for Leading in Energy and Environmental Design. And it was created by the U.S. Green Building Council. And you get points for how green your construction or renovation is, everything from the amount of natural daylight to the reuse of materials. And Budahan says there are no standards for homes just yet, but he believes people want to renovate green. And he showed me his prototype home, which is his own.
So what has he done there?
Well, it starts outside. Now, this is one of your classic Winnipeg pre-World War I two-story homes with the porch on the front and the brick facade. And this is very much a construction zone. But there's already a certain wow factor to the house. There's this new two-story porch on the front. But he didn't take the typical route from taking down the old sagging porch to building the new one.
So we took everything that was here, as much as we could of the brick and the wood. We took it apart. It was very painstaking. And then eventually we got everything out of there. And I built a design for a two-story deck with used certified wood. FSC is a Forest Stewardship Council. That's wood that's going to be from a forest that's built specifically for lumber.
Now, he put the deck together using bolts and screws so it can be taken apart and salvaged rather than ripped down and thrown out in the future. And James is trying to apply these principles to all his work in the house.
So speaking of in the house, we started outside. What's he doing inside?
Well, inside is in full renovation mode. So it takes a little bit of imagination to see the potential, but it's one of those places that's seen a lot over the past almost 100 years, including some really bad cedar paneling and nasty carpet. And in keeping with the deconstruction idea, everything was painstakingly taken apart and saved for either reuse or sale. Now, the floors, unfortunately, were in such bad shape that James is going to have to replace them, but he's going green with a concrete floor.
Concrete also has thermal mass qualities. We're trying to get as much sunlight in to absorb into the concrete floor. Now, what concrete does is it absorbs heat during the day, and then it releases it at night. So during the day, it actually cools off your house, and at night it warms it up when it's colder out. And it does it all by itself. You don't have to buy any special equipment, anything like that. The other thing, too, is concrete. There's a whole realm of decorative possibilities for concrete. The plan is to make the concrete here look exactly like the black granite tile that we're using in the kitchen.
And what's really interesting, he's going to use some of the old carpet and even used coffee grounds to create patterns and textures in the new concrete floor.
Coffee grounds.
Yeah. It'll smell great.
Okay. Now, has he tried to go green in terms of the electrical system in the house too?
Yeah, this is really interesting, especially for anyone like me who's ever dealt with replacing old wiring wanting to move.
Been there.
Yeah. And this is an old house, of course. And James says it will be wireless wiring.
Basically, everything is... Your switch is connected to your panel, your main electrical panel, and the light itself uses radio signals. So the switch will connect using radio signals to the light, which means that there's no wiring and such. So typically in renovation, you knock down walls, you fish wire up. Now it means if anyone takes this house and wants to change where lights are, they can just move the light. And there's not that added kind of hassle of fishing through wire and connecting everything.
Come on, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's new. It's being worked on, and it's not. Now it's not cheap.
Let's put it that way.
Okay, it's between $20 to $30 a fixture. But James says the lights will last forever, and they'll be easy to locate.
Okay, what about bathroom stuff? He's working on that too, right?
Well, this is really fascinating. Both the office and the bathroom, which is like a total story unto itself, and I'll get to that in a minute, will be powered by solar panels. And James says it would cost more than $40,000 to run an entire home on solar panels. So one or two rooms are actually something the average person could do. Now, this bathroom will be a hoot when it's finished. Have you ever heard of hot yoga?
Tried it?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this will be a wet room / hot yoga room for his fiance. And James says it will be all concrete with simple ceramic heaters you can find at home stores.
And we're going to put them onto the wall, and they're going to be connected to one solar panel. So actually, these panels generating the heat won't be using up energy. They'll be just using the power of the sun. And then this place could be heated up, and you could do your hot yoga in here. Me and the wife Well, more the wife than me. I just kind of hear about it, but it'll heat up the place. The concrete, again, has a thermal mass, so it's going to absorb the heat, kind of like a big bacon oven, a big ceramic pot here, and it's going to make heat resonate out here, so you can do your hot yoga in here and then take a shower afterwards, I guess.
If I were visiting, though, I'd never go to the bathroom. I'd be like sweating when I came out of there. Is that it for the wonders of the greenhouse or anything else to mention?
No, I mean, there'll be the standard high efficiency furnace and new windows and insulation and the like. But another interesting feature, which James says has never been done before, he's building a green deck. And sort of like the green roofs that we've seen on the mountain equipment.
You mean with grass on them?
Yeah, on the deck. So he'll add green space, plus it will filter the rainwater that goes into the sewer system.
Okay, now this all sounds interesting, but it also sounds expensive.
Yeah, let's show me the money.
Yeah, exactly. Well, typical Winnipeg. But I asked him what the price tag was, and I think his response speaks for himself.
It's getting up there. See, I work with a really great contractor, so he's really cool about... like, you know, I kind of don't have any money right now, but he's very on board too. So that kind of helps with the expenses, which is one of the important things, is make sure you've got a contractor that is on board too. One of the things I learned from the architectural industry is that when you want to go green, everyone's got to be on the same page.
So after a bit more prodding, James admitted the renovation is coming close to $35,000. That's for the whole house. And that's not too bad, considering what the home will be like when it's done, or the fact that you can spend, I know this one, at least that on a kitchen renovation. And he hopes it'll be finished at least enough to live in the next 4 weeks.
All right. Thanks, Meg.
Megan Ketchison is a reporter with CBC Radio. Well, c'est ça. That's it for this week. But never fear, we're not too far away from your ears at any point. You can check us out at 89.3 FM in Winnipeg, 990 AM in southern Manitoba, or stream us live at cbc.ca/Manitoba. If you're surfing the web, by the way, don't forget to drop us a line at manitobapodcast@cbc.ca. Who knows? I could be talking about what you've written next week. This episode of Manitoba This Week was released November 3rd, 2007. The podcast is produced by Ruth Shedd. I'm Marcy Marcusa. Ta-ta for now.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.